For New Yorkers without good health insurance, safety net hospitals are a key source of care as they have a mission to provide services regardless of an individual's ability to pay their bill at the end of a stay. And it's because of this business model that these facilities are extremely reliant on revenue sources besides their patients, such as the state. In light of the recently adopted, record-setting $220 billion state budget, we wanted to see what state lawmakers and Governor Hochul had invested in safety net hospitals and examine the financial health of these types of facilities in New York. And to do that, we're joined on the phone by Leray Brown, president and CEO of the One Brooklyn Health System, which includes three hospitals, among many other facilities. Welcome to the show, Leray.
Thank you very much, David. Good to be here.
And also on the line is Dr. David Perlstein, president and CEO of the SBH Health System, which includes a Bronx hospital. Hello, David.
Hi, David. Thanks for having us here.
So I mentioned in the introduction the mission of safety net hospitals pretty broadly. But, Leray, can you quantify what this actually means in reality for your hospitals? What are the sort of services that you provide in a community, and how might that differ from other hospitals?
So very specifically, safety net hospitals are hospitals and health systems that serve high numbers of Medicaid patients, of patients insured by the government, but mostly through Medicaid, as well as high numbers of uninsured or underinsured individuals. And in terms of, David, in terms of the services, we provide a full range of services, many of which would be considered essential, such as psychiatric or behavioral health services, emergency departments, trauma. Many of us serve as the trauma centers in our particular regions or catchment areas. And we're also significant providers of outpatient services, primary care, dental care, outpatient mental health, outpatient substance abuse services. Again, a full range of healthcare services, as well as services that support individuals in areas other than their physical and mental health. We provide programs for pregnant teens, programs to support children and mothers, and programs that provide additional supports for individuals who suffer from chronic diseases.
Well, David, then what's the financial fallout from treating Medicaid patients who often are getting reimbursed at rates below what private insurance might provide, as well as patients without any insurance? How do you make the math work as a hospital?
To be perfectly honest, David, you can't make the math work, not without finding some additional funds to support your bottom line. You know, at SBH, we're a large independent hospital, a community anchor healthcare provider, and we deliver complex and primary care to our Bronx neighbors, which includes trauma center, large ambulatory care networks. But also we've doubled down on really trying to focus on wellness and addressing kind of the common social determinants of health that interfere with populations being able to stay healthy and avoid coming to the hospital acutely. So we're trying to invest in programs that address food insecurity, housing insecurity, and other issues. But when you're only getting about 62 cents on the dollar for the services that you're providing, and you know that some of your wealthier, I would argue, whiter communities have hospitals that are actually getting seven times that for their commercial payers, they can do things that we are unable to do. Yet we still know that it's part of our mission and visions to actually make the impact that we've been talking about.
Well, Leray, because, as David says, the math doesn't work if you're just basing it off on what patients can pay and what their insurance can pay, where does the rest of the money come that does enable safety net hospitals to actually keep the lights on and keep the doors open?
And well, that money comes from the state, frankly. As an example, One Brooklyn Health, we have a budget gap of close to, I would say, a little less than $500 million. That sounds overwhelming. And over the last several years, we've gotten supplemental funding from the state, not of our to address our full need, but we've gotten supplemental funding from the state of about $300 million. That's on top of our patient revenue, on top of what we get paid for our Medicaid patients, on top of what we get paid for our Medicare patients, because there frankly has been an acknowledgement by the state that the Medicaid reimbursement levels are, as David said, 62 cents on the dollar. And to keep our doors open, we've needed that supplemental funding. But it's not enough. And frankly, we much prefer there be structural reform in what Medicaid pays, in the acknowledgement of a sustainable rate of reimbursement in the Medicaid program, an acknowledgement that our services are so essential, and that, as David said, we're also essential anchors. One Brooklyn employs more than 7,000 people, many of whom live in Brooklyn. So we're not just centers of health care, but we're also the economic drivers for our communities.
Well, David, what's your experience like with funding from the state? And does it seem like this funding is flexible in the sense that it changes year to year, or is it following some sort of formula that you're able to count on in terms of money on an annual basis?
You know, SBH, under a former model, when we were really thinking about volume as the primary driver of care, and obviously this was before 2008, which is the last time Medicaid rates were actually increased, we used to be in pretty good shape. So we would get paid for volume, and we would see a lot of patients, and we'd be able to make a profit, which would allow us to reinvest in the organization. Well, you know, I'm a pediatrician by training, and I've focused my whole career on patient-centered care, and I've recognized for a long time that patients really shouldn't be in hospitals. You know, and that comes out of a lot of research and data that does show that you should try to take care of patients where they are and prevent as much as possible taking them into an area that actually has risk. And hospitals are places that have risk. So we changed the way we delivered care. And as part of that change, we decreased the number of patients that we were admitted through the emergency department. And then luckily, it was supported ultimately by the delivery system reform, where the state was really committed for a 5-year period to decrease the number of unnecessary inpatient and ER admissions. And we did very well under that model. However, just when we were coming out of this, the state did not get the system renewed by CMS. This is the waiver. And as a result, we had to kind of change back to a semi-volume-driven model. And as I said, if you're getting 62 cents on the dollar of expense, and by the way, that care is getting more expensive since COVID started, there's no way to break even. Now, the question about whether we've been getting some model that drives how we get money from the state, it really hasn't been driven by that. It really has been, for at least for us, meeting with the state, identifying what our shortfalls are, and they're agreeing to fund us just to the point of not having to close the door or do layoffs. Now, I can tell you, as someone who has both an MD and an MBA, I know how to run a business. There's no way to really strategically plan how you're going to change or improve your systems without being able to reinvest in that system, and that takes capital. And because we've really received subsistence funding up until this year, it makes it very, very hard for us to move forward and try to do things that result in change. And this year, I'm hopeful, because the state did address some of the limits in their model, but it's not really gone far enough. And what we will need, and I think I heard LeRae say, we will need structural payment reform in order to change this permanently.
I want to emphasize that the funding to the safety net has really been just enough to keep our doors open, just enough to avoid significant layoffs, and not enough for us to be able to change the service delivery model, as my colleague has talked about, and more importantly, to sustain a changed delivery model. Because when SBH attempted through the waiver period of time to change, those funding did not continue. So there was no sustainability with the DSRIP waiver. And importantly, in terms of capital, we don't have cash to start up new programs, even when we know those new programs and services could work to prevent individuals from using unnecessarily the emergency departments or staying in the hospital longer than they need to. So again, the model doesn't work, and it doesn't work for those institutions, those hospitals that are in communities where there's many social needs and in communities in which there's been no investment and in communities where people, in some instances, up to 23-25% of the residents live in poverty. And again, if they're insured, they're insured through the public government programs, which in and of themselves do not pay for the cost of care.
Thinking about the future, there's legislation, which, to be candid, is on the fast train to nowhere, that would change the way the state's indigent care pool is distributed each year, essentially ensuring that hospitals with means, with some of these well-insured clients, aren't getting as large a share of this money as they are currently. Would enacting something like that, that kind of formula structure in law, make a difference for safety net hospitals moving forward?
It would make an important difference. It would not resolve the problem, but as you mentioned, it's redistributive, right? So there will be winners and losers. And as those dollars are directed to the hospitals that serve a disproportionate number of Medicaid and uninsured patients, we would get more of the funds, and that would also help us, but it would not solve the problems in terms of our structural budget gaps.
And finally, as we think about the future, are there any solutions to the needs of safety net hospitals that don't revolve around money? Is there anything that the legislature could do or officials in Washington, D.C. could do that could strengthen the safety net hospitals, close any gaps in the hospitals, and ensure their long-term survival that might not necessarily cost something but would just require maybe some sort of regulations changes or some other sort of enticements?
Everything takes money. And of course, there are changes that can occur and should occur in terms of what healthcare organizations should be doing and how we should be directing our resources to better serve our patient population. But when you are confronted with not enough funding to support your employees to pay your bills, the resolution has to first be additional resources so that there can be viability and not eking out, as my colleague had said, eking out a subsistence existence.
Regulatory relief would be great. Changing some laws would be great. But we also need to really find the funding to support transformation of the whole system. Our healthcare system, in my opinion, is not designed well, and it's not designed around patients. And we certainly are seeing that very clearly as we've been trying to deal with COVID, but also what's happening after COVID. And I don't want to go back to what we were before COVID. I think that we can find ways to deliver care in a more affordable fashion that actually focuses on putting patients first and preventing their needing to come to emergency departments or inpatient facilities. I've said many times I'm probably the only CEO in the country that is looking forward to the date that I can shut down my inpatient facility, because that would have meant that I would have solved the issue around keeping patients healthier. And my patients are not my patients in my community. My community is not a healthy community because that's not where the money goes. So I think there is an opportunity for the feds. There's an opportunity for Albany. But it's going to require real commitment to structural reform.
Well, finally, one more bill I want to just ask about, another one that's going nowhere fast, is the New York Health Act, which would lead to basically a state takeover of health insurance. Is that something that you think would be beneficial to safety net hospitals, or do you feel like that would ultimately be a net negative for safety net hospitals?
I'm a strong believer in a single-payer system. I would love to see that happen. I do not think that works at a state level. I think that has to be a national commitment, because I think there are so many uncertainties in the funding. And I think that we're experiencing this year and with COVID. Remember, if we hadn't received the federal funding during COVID, there's no way that SBH would still be open. And I would argue probably One Brooklyn wouldn't have been open either.
That is true.
So I am all for moving towards a reform that results in equity of service and payment, which is what this is supposed to do. But I think there are other models out there that could work. I think Maryland has a wonderful model, and I think that the state's looking at it.
And there are other models of payment reform that don't go as far as a single payer system, but models that pay fairly, pay equitably for the services provided, regardless of the patient population, and that sort of level the playing field amongst the hospitals and healthcare networks within a region. Maryland being one, I think there's discussion in North Carolina. So there's lots of discussion about different ways of supporting the healthcare infrastructure in the region. But as my colleague said, that, you know, a single payer system works when you have a single payer system, and that would be across the country.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. We've been speaking with One Brooklyn Health's president and CEO, Larae Brown. Larae, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And also on the phone has been SBH Health System President and CEO, Dr. David Perlstein. Thank you, Dr. Perlstein.
Thank you, David.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by the New York State AFL-CIO, a federation of 3,000 unions fighting for working people by keeping New York State union strong. UnionStrongNY.com for more information.